I'm Emily Rooney. This is Boston Public Radio. Well, even though both presidential candidates took the weekend off, President Obama was playing golf and celebrating his 51st birthday at Camp David, and Mitt Romney was up at his place in New Hampshire. Their campaign surrogates were slugging it out all over the Sunday talk shows. Still at issue, those pesky tax returns of Mitt Romney's. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid was saying that Romney hasn't paid income. He says he had it on a good source. It hasn't paid his an income tax in 10 years. And that prompted the RNC chair, Reince Priebus, to say that Harry Reid is a dirty liar. Meanwhile, everybody else is just saying, why don't you just release the taxes already and, you know, put the issue aside. We're going to be talking about that and more today on Politics as Usual. Joining me here in Studio 3 are Rob Eno, publisher of the Red Mask Group blog, and Glenn Johnson, political editor for the Boston Globe. Glenn, I was a little surprised that Harry Reid said it the way he said it, because people in the journalistic world like yourself get those kinds of tips all the time. I mean, somebody said, I got it on really good authority that Mitt Romney hasn't paid an income tax. By that, they probably mean that his losses in the stock market or whatever offset his gains, and you know, so he didn't pay an actual income tax. But to then say it, yeah, as if you had actually seen the returns, seemed, yeah, a little...
Politics is a world of hyperbole, and this is so far beyond that. My jaw dropped when I read it, because if we go over this standard where we can say somebody told me such and such and say it in a public forum and then have it introduced into the mass media by Huffington Post, you know, you've really gone over an edge there. I mean, take out tax returns and say, I heard Mitt Romney was cheating on his wife,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
where people would be up in arms over that, you know, and I think that just because this is about tax returns, to admit that you don't know whether it's true and then to say nothing more than this is from a reliable source, you know, is really beyond the pale in terms of public discourse, and it doesn't meet any sort of journalistic standard for, you know, reporting something in the paper or on the
web.
No,
it doesn't.
And it doesn't meet any sort of legal standard either. Like, you couldn't say this in court. You know, it's just beyond the pale that he would say something like this. And you know, I'm not surprised the Republicans are jumping on it, because it's justified.
You're not going to get any fight from Rob Eno.
No, I think David Bernstein wrote something today on his blog that said that it's the equivalent of the pulling it out of your butt defense.
Yeah.
Is basically what he did. Is he said no. I mean, I get accused all the time as a crazy right wing blogger of saying things without sourcing, but I
that's
try
never
to source
to you, has it?
I try to source everything I do just for those reasons, because if you don't, then you get accused of just repeating stuff. It's what's really galling to me is that he said it on the floor of the Senate.
Yeah, he said it on that's true.
He didn't say it to
a
reporter,
show,
it wasn't,
yeah,
on a Sunday talk show, it wasn't anything. He used the power of his office and the sanctity of the United States Senate rostrum to say it. And I think that's just that I think more than anything is where we need to take a step back. And there's nobody that says that Romney didn't. I completely agree with Glenn. You could insert anything into that. And, you know, it's the National Enquirer standard of reporting. That was one of the funny things I saw all weekend, is all these Facebook photos, and it had other things that, you know, his source, and it had pictures of aliens and stuff
that
like that,
funny.
Because, you know,
well,
that's...
But I have to say, though... Reince Priebus, the RNC chair, kind of took it to a new low himself. Here is he yesterday on ABC's This Week.
As far as Harry Reid is concerned, listen, I know you might want to go down that road. I'm not going to respond to a dirty liar who hasn't filed a single page of tax returns himself. The fact
Mr.
that we're
Chairman,
going to spend any time talking about
you
it
say
is
you're
just
not going to
ridiculous.
Respond, but you just called him a dirty liar. You stand by that? You think Harry Reid's a dirty liar?
I just said it.
Well, that didn't make sense to me,
yeah,
either, to call somebody a liar. I mean, because, he, you know, to say he doesn't know something to be true, but that doesn't mean he's a liar. He thinks what he said has some merit to it. So it was, the whole thing got totally warped as far as I was concerned. That wasn't a classy move either. He could have said what Glenn Johnson just said and said, you could have substituted anything there and it's outrageous, but, you know, a liar, it seemed weak.
Well, you get into the fight of a campaign, and that's kind of the role of the party, as opposed to the campaign, is to do stuff like that. Maybe that was a bit much, but, you know, if who knows? If we don't know if Harry Reid just made it up out of whole cloth. I don't know. He could have.
The Romney campaign also says it's not true. I mean, Eric Fernstrom, I saw him being interviewed by Candy Crowley last Friday, I believe, or Thursday, and he said it's flat not true. So if it's not true and Harry Reid is saying that, then he is a liar. I mean, there's no, you know, well, you can sugarcoat it, but he's not telling the truth if they're saying it's not true.
Well, there's a lot of way to parse tax returns, as you know.
Right, right.
You know, if he got out, did he get out his checkbook and write a check? Did he have something deducted? He doesn't have a paycheck. So the question is, did he offset losses and that kind of thing, which is perfectly legal and doesn't mean that he didn't pay taxes.
Right.
But the bottom line here, Rob, is that Mitt Romney could resolve this by releasing a couple years of tax research. He's going to have to do it.
He has released a couple years of tax
one,
research.
I think. One.
He's released one. I mean, you know, we still don't have, and you know, crazy right-wing Rob, but we still don't have the transcripts of Barack Obama in college, and we have other candidates' transcripts. He's never released those. There's lots of transparency things to go around.
That's two hugely different things.
Transcripts from college.
Has anybody seen Mitt Romney's transcript? I don't think so.
There's been stories about the grades that he's got.
There's been people who've been saying we need Barack Obama's, but that's not a standard, normal standard for political reporting and other things. You know, Romney does make himself vulnerable on this topic by not releasing his tax returns, but he's already laid out the course of action that he's going to pursue on this. He said, I've given out my 2010 return. I'm going to release my 2011 return when it's done, which it's kind of a farce because this thing could have been done by now. I mean, you got to assume that they're just waiting the absolute
as
long as they can to release this return. But he's taking a legitimate political hit for not returning, not releasing these returns. But there's a big leap between not releasing your returns and somebody going on the floor of the Senate and saying that I heard something and I can't back it up. That takes it to a whole new level. Romney is taking a hit for it, but Harry Reid should also take a hit for saying something he can't back up.
Do you think he has?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he has, and he's actually made Dan Kennedy today in the whole back and forth with David Bernstein on the Facebook said that, you know, Harry Reid has made Mitt Romney a sympathetic figure in all of this because of what he's done. So they've taken what, you know, was, as Glenn said, a demonstrably positive for the Obama campaign and a negative for Romney and kind of switched it the other way. And it's almost, you know, the worst possible thing Harry Reid could have done.
In certain worlds, and maybe in the journalistic world, but in other worlds, it's probably like, oh, yeah, the guy didn't pay any taxes. And, you know, depends on who's hearing what message.
Yeah, It does depend on who's hearing what message, but I think it does. I think in the normal standard of human beings, though, if they know that there was nothing to back it up, it's the same thing. It makes Mitt Romney a sympathetic figure that he's getting attacked.
Mitt Romney has said point blank that he has paid taxes every year and a lot of taxes. And that better be true, too, because it's one thing,
definitely,
as he said, to offset, you know, losses with, I mean, as I said, perfectly legal, and it doesn't mean that you didn't actually pay something or lose some money, but it's a big difference.
There's been some intelligent analysis of this. They've gone out and they've talked to private equity people, they've talked to tax attorneys, and they've said that with the market crash in 08, that in 09, if you're somebody as heavily invested as Mitt Romney, there is a very good chance that in that 09 return, you know, he could have, you know, substantial write-offs, and maybe he didn't pay taxes in that 1 year. But there's a big difference between somebody analyzing it and justifying why they think, you know, raising a possibility, and somebody like Harry Reid just going out and saying, somebody told me and I can't back it up. And so, you know, there's a lot of different ways to look at the Romney tax question and to put it into the political discourse. Harry Reid just took an extreme way that if people don't react to it and shout it down, I mean, where do you draw the line going forward?
Well, I haven't heard too many. Certainly the Democrats haven't shouted it
down. Well, where's the president on it?
Yeah, the president should. You're right.
I mean, this is the guy that the president is running against, and the head of his party in the Senate has said something that he can't back up. Barack Obama's talking about what a positive administration and transparent administration he wants to run, and then he's letting this hang out there. You know, I'm surprised that, you know, there hasn't been more pressure on the president to say something and repudiate.
Yeah, because he was away all weekend, but you're right.
I mean, and you don't know who Harry Reid got it on the good. Yeah, right, dreads of is it the Obama campaign that he got it on the good, you know,
well,
graces of? We don't know.
On it.
But that's kind of doing what Harry did.
Likely,
but it's
somebody
like,
from the Romney campaign. Right. But I mean, and no one, it's like, who could have seen his tax returns other than somebody who helped prepare them? And, you know.
Or somebody from the McCain campaign in 08 who saw all 23 years of that.
Did they see all 23 years?
Well,
they said
I think A.B. Culverhouse probably saw him and other people like that. But I'm not saying accusing him of anything. I'm just saying there are other people who have probably seen some returns over the years. But, you know, to be able to say that, that's why I agree with you. It's like who actually would have seen them and then would have said something like this? You know, it's you know.
I mean, Romney's been trying to turn this around, focus on, you know, there was that jobs report last Friday that was relatively weak and unemployment actually went up a notch and around 10% to, like, I think it was 8.2 it landed at. But
8.3, yeah.
8.3. He's claiming he's going to, you know, build 12 million jobs, you know, right off the bat. But he's short on the details. Does anybody know how? Last time I checked, presidents aren't really in the business of creating jobs. I mean, how does the president of the United States create jobs?
They put together the certainty and the groundwork that people would want to invest. If you talk to a lot of business people, with the Obamacare mandates coming down and not knowing from year to year whether or not there'll be the extension of the Bush tax cuts, there's a lot of uncertainty in the small business world. And I think that what Mitt would do is he would say, I'm going to sign a four-year extension. I'm going to sign a multi-year extension of the Bush tax cuts. We're going to stop playing this every single game, every single year coming up, because it becomes a tax increase at this point. And I think there'll be some certainty with the Mitt Romney presidency. And I think business owners just don't see that certainty right now.
He says there won't be another federal stimulus package, that there's no proof that that worked under either Bush or President Obama.
Right. It didn't work. I mean, we're still at 8.3%, and would we have been in a different place? And the thing with the stimulus package is, you know, you're talking about, did we spend it on infrastructure? We spent $700 billion, and we spent $60 billion of it on infrastructure. The rest of it got spent giving it out to, you know, helping banks and then helping green energy companies grow and a lot of crony capitalist type things. And so if we had taken that $700 billion and spent it on infrastructure, I think a lot of people would have a lot different look at it right now. But that's not what we did. We gave it to the
friends of the
president.
Those are all short-term jobs, though.
But they are short-term jobs, but the long-term stuff's not working either, because we're propping up companies and stopping them from failing for a couple of years. I'm a big believer that you should be able to make it or not make it on your own, and that you don't need the government to prop you up, and that in the end, that just doesn't work. It's the whole, where the bank's too big to fail. I think the bank should have failed. I don't think we should have helped them, because we'd be in a much better situation than we are now. We would have gone through it. It would have been a little bit maybe harder than it was, but we might have gotten out of it a little bit easier.
A lot of people would have lost a lot of money.
Right. As I said earlier, there's a lot of hyperbole that we engage in politics. You hear candidates talk about things, and you know that some of them aren't literal interpretations of things. They're sort of a philosophical expression of their beliefs. You know, he talks about creating 12 million jobs. I mean, how do you define that specific number? But as Rob said, he can create a climate where certain things would happen in terms of how he would approach tax policy, how he would approach, say, an infrastructure program. But, you know, one of the things that we also have to look at through the course of the remainder of this campaign is, can you make the numbers add up? And Mitt Romney so far has put out very vague economic plans. He's talked in general terms about things he wants to do. He's put out these specific numbers, but you cannot get a very detailed plan from his campaign staff about, you know, what is his tax policy? What's his budget cutting policy? How do you do certain things in your program and not have other impacts on that whole country's economy? And so, you know, that hopefully is what's going to happen over the course of these debates coming up, you know, the general election campaign and the convention speeches that are still to come.
Talking to Glenn Johnson, political editor for the Boston Globe, and Rob Eno, publisher of the Red Mass Group blog. Moving on to some of our own races here. I mean, doesn't it feel like the Senate race is just kind of like treading water? And all due respect to the, you know, prestigious Boston Globe, I just went cross-eyed trying to read that 87th profile of Scott Brown on yesterday's. I just couldn't do it. And it was very similar to the book, and it was similar to, I mean, I know there's an obligation for the papers. I say the same thing about the New York Times, you know, the 87th story on Mitt Romney's Mormonism, you know. It's just on and on and on. You have to do it and you have to recycle it, but I couldn't get through it.
I think that beyond that story, I think that there was a very compelling story. I think it was in the Saturday paper where Michael Levinson went out with both of them and traveled with them as they talk about infrastructure. So there's something that, you know, is on the table right now. And you have Scott Brown outlining his approach, and you have Elizabeth Warren outlining their approaches, her approach. And between those two, you're starting to see this philosophical divide between the two of them. You have the different reactions to the "you didn't build that" comment by the president. And again, hyperbole, some things aren't exactly what the president said. But in that debate, you're starting to see the real philosophical contrast between these two candidates. And so I actually feel like that campaign is coming alive. Mm. That now, you know, the Senate went out of session on Friday. Scott Brown is going to be back, or Thursday, he's going to be back up here now campaigning for the bulk of this month. And then we move right into September and we start some debates. And
that's when it's going to make the difference.
You know, you're really going to see
the crystallization of that campaign. Elizabeth Warren was talking about spending $100 billion on roads, bridges, schools, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. And Scott Brown is really focusing on the small business message. So there was a bit of a breakaway there. But it doesn't necessarily mean that either or situation for Scott Brown, that he wouldn't support spending on infrastructure. But, you know, he has picked up on that, you know, you didn't build it without me comment from President Obama. And that's sort of he's trying to appeal to small businesses.
Well, that story, too, if you look at, you know, Michael Levinson talked to Elizabeth Warren's campaign and said, okay, if you want to spend all this money on infrastructure, if you hold China up as an example of a country that spends 9% of its GDP on infrastructure and the U.S. is only 2%, you know, it sounds like you're talking about a second stimulus plan. How do you pay for that? And she went through a litany of ideas, about 4 or 5 ideas for creating an infrastructure bank and some other things. You ask Scott Brown about that, and quite often what you hear is the same thing. You hear, we're going to get rid of waste, fraud, and abuse in the government. You know, I would like to do some of these things, but I don't want to raise taxes. Okay, well, then how do you pay for them? And he says, well, we're going to get rid of fraud, waste, fraud, and abuse in government. So that becomes a lot more gray when you're trying to get specifics from him on some of these things, too. But again, it's the start of a real philosophical and political battle between the two of them.
That original quote by Elizabeth Warren, which was actually the you didn't do this on your own. His original quote that the president took, but her original quote came from George Lakoff, who's a professor from Berkeley. He wrote, he's been pushing that message for a while. So she's parroting that, and then the president's parroting that. That original one is one of the biggest, in going to the drawing the lines, one of the biggest Rorschach tests I've ever seen in politics. You either love that quote or you hate that quote. There is no middle ground on that quote with people that I've talked to. It's just that visceral. And you know,
I don't know too many people who love it.
You don't read Blue Mask Group enough, because they are very in the progressive movement across the nation is. But you know, I think one of the things that you look at is she held up China, and she uses the 9% thing. But if you look at the actual number, 9% of GDP.
Oh yeah.
And if you look at the United States historically, we've been between 2.2 and 3% for the past 50 years. That includes the building of the interstate highway system. We're spending more now per capita than we were back then on an inflation-adjusted basis. We're spending twice on a per capita basis than they're spending in China. So it's a lot about outcomes, too. It's, you know, they're building cities that are empty for millions of people that just sit empty because they're building it. There's also a lot of private infrastructure that we do in the United States for the electrical grid, for ports and things like that, that aren't counted in that 2% number, that are done privately in the United States, where in a place like China or the European Union, they're done by the government. So there's a lot of differences there. And I think that, you know, one of the things, and they say that they didn't make the reference to China to bring up China, but you did. You know, you could have said the European Union spends 5%, because the European Union does spend about 5% of GDP. They made a thing with that. And then if you look at it, if you look at places like North Korea that spend money on some infrastructure, they've got empty 7-lane highways. So it does take the entrepreneur and does take the person to take those risks to use the infrastructure that's there. And I think that that's the point that Scott Brown's making.
I know, but if you look at the policy debate, both in the Senate campaign and in the presidential campaign, China is often held up as our chief economic rival. And so I think when you're talking about infrastructure that powers your economy, holding up China as the example or the measuring stick for how you're doing isn't necessarily way off base. And Scott Brown has done it himself. I mean, Mitt Romney does it. He talks about China, and whether or not we're measuring up in certain regards. Certainly, every time you hear somebody talking about education policy, China and other Asian nations are always held up as the example of where we used to be and where we're not right now, and who our competitors are, the number of engineering degrees coming out of China. So, it's morphed into this, oh, she wants to, support communist China, which I don't think is the same as citing an example of a nation that's a direct economic competitor of ours and how they're apportioning some of their budgeting and then comparing it to the United States.
And again,
it's not
I think
an embrace of the communist system necessarily.
But then again, it does come into that whole soundbite politics and doing it in a short thing because it doesn't tell the whole story. The reason they're spending that much on their infrastructure is, 10 years ago, they didn't have multi-lane highways.
Right.
They didn't have all of the things that we've built up over time and that we have and now that we're maintaining.
They like to do things in a hurry, too.
They include
just
to
get it done. The manpower.
Yeah. Tyner Robb Eno, publisher of the Red Mask Group blog, and Glenn Johnson, political editor of the Boston Herald. I mean, Boston Globe. I keep doing that, switching the titles. Anyway, you took note this morning, Glenn, that over the weekend that Gail Huff, Scott Brown's wife, is taking a leave from her part-time job at WJLA. I have to say, I respect her enormously for doing that. I mean, she appeared in an ad within the last couple of months, which we did a piece on Beat the Press. You just can't do it.
Yeah,
I know it's his wife and all that, but you can't be a journalist and appear in a political ad for anybody, including your husband. So I think stepping back from it, just recognizing that that's really where her heart lies with getting him reelected, I mean, it makes sense. I mean, Maria Shriver had to make this decision.
Mm-hmm.
Several others have had you just... it's a conflict of interest.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, because it's just the latest example of how bio-driven his campaign is. I mean, his daughters and his wife have been integral parts of this campaign, even his dogs,
his truck.
Walking around his dogs.
His jacket.
Truck. It's all, he has a very strong image-laden campaign. I mean, there is obviously a policy layer to the whole thing, too, but many of his commercials and a lot of what he talks about in the story in the paper over the weekend in his own book is about that life story, because they believe that in that life story, everybody out there who is the lunch bucket Democratic voters that they want to try and draw over to the Republican side are people that can relate to that. So the idea that Gail, who everybody knows from TV around here, is taking time off to help Scott, on this first name basis, it just fuels that whole aim of theirs.
No, that's true. I went to the induction of the Lord Mayor of West Roxbury event a few months ago, the patch, the Huffington Post thing. They did this thing where this guy won, and it was the most amazing civic event I've been to in 20 years. We used to do this sort of stuff in the French community in Lowell all the time, and it's kind of gone away. But you had a room filled with thousands above the fire code of people from West Roxbury to support this guy. Scott walks in and he's a rock star in places like West Roxbury. And it's a lot of the Democratic City Committee guys that are supporting Scott. And I think that it's because of that bio-driven, and
Absolutely.
You can have a beer with him, you can do those sorts of things. And I think Scott's just a genuinely likable person when you sit down and you meet him on a one-on-one basis. And I think that that's a lot of what's fueled his campaigns from the beginning. He goes out and I think he still knocks on doors. They make a big, this big thing of him not doing town halls, not doing this sort of thing. Well, on weekends, since he's been elected and before he's been elected, he goes out and he goes to a diner in the middle of nowhere and goes and sits with people for an hour or so with it outside of the cameras. And people talk about that and you hear about that in those communities. And he's the best retail politician I think this state's seen in a long,
Absolutely.
Long time.
All right. One more local issue. Over the weekend, the John Tierney campaign, 6th District Congressman, had apparently started making robocalls, barking at his opponent, Richard Tessé. And the Republicans are basically saying it's a desperate attempt because so much attention has been called to what John Tierney knew about the dealings that his wife had with her brother's offshore gambling operation. So I don't know. I don't have a good sense for this race at all. It seems like Richard Tessé should be doing better than he is. It hasn't been a very noisy campaign yet. And I don't know. I mean, he has taken a few cracks at him on this, but not much.
I think that the Tissé campaign has just completely hammered him and continue to hammer him on this issue. And I think that they're driving a lot of the stories coming back out. I think what they did today was interesting, where they're talking about Abby. You know, they send out a press release.
Yeah, this is his voice.
Who is Abby? Who is Abby?
It's kind of like the Siri, the Apple.
I think
Siri.
Abby might be related to Julia. They might both, you know.
So Abby is this robo, to make it clear. She's the voice of this robo
The
call.
Voice of this robo call. Yeah. And it's you know, hi, this is Abby calling. Did you know that Richard Tissé is evil?
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those type of robo calls. And I think that the DCCC is very scared. I mean, you had this Sunlight Foundation, Common Cause, and Center for Responsive Politics, all of which are funded in large part by left-wing institutes. I mean, it's the Common Cause and the Center for Responsive Politics are both part of the George Soros family of companies. And the Sunlight Foundation is the Pew Trust and the Ford Foundation and all these other things that fund these groups. And for them to be calling, for him to be transparent, for him to come out, I think is a big step. And I mean, Common Cause has done that a lot in Massachusetts. I mean, Pam Wilmot doesn't really care, I don't think, who she attacks when she attacks somebody for being untransparent. But I mean, it's an interesting development. It's every time you turn around, it's more and more. And I think your piece, John Tierney should have known that when he was helicoptering into the Antigua establishment that there was gambling, you know, it's John Renault Tierney, you know, Inspector Renault. I'm shocked to find that there's gambling going on in this establishment.
Exactly. And then this thing about these checks has come out also that Patrice Tierney was writing herself checks each month to the tune of $1,000. And this is from accounts she was overseeing on behalf of her brother. As I said, you know, you can keep your finances somewhat, you know, if I'm going to buy a $5,000 dress, maybe I wouldn't want my husband to know. But, you know, basic income and that kind of stuff, it's everybody, you know, you can't, that's not a secret from, you know, your spouse. I mean, if she was making a salary, I'm sure he depended on that for living expenses. Like, I mean, how could you not know what somebody, it's income taxes.
This whole issue is now getting the examination. It was very difficult to have happen the last campaign. You know, this settlement, her guilty plea came, I think, October 6th or 7th. The election was 4 weeks later. He was running against a very weakened candidate at that time. And now there's been a chance to go through the court papers, go through the court transcripts, compare his statements to votes, things like that. And so it's getting the full vetting that it occurred. And I think, you know, when you talk about not sure how this race is going, you know, when you go up into that area and you talk to people,
we've been up there.
There's a lot of people that are like a lot of, you know, watchful waiting here. People are taking all this in and trying to
anecdotally process people
it.
Still seem to be backing John Tierney.
Yeah, right? I mean, it's still a pretty heavily Democratic district. It picked up some favorable to say territory in redistricting, but you know, you go from Salem up to mill cities like Lawrence and stuff, he still has an area there where, you know, he can draw support. And I think there's a lot of people out there also that feel like, you know, is he necessarily his brother's keeper in this whole thing? But at least there'll be a full vetting of you know, the whole charge here.
Should there be a House Ethics Committee investigation into this?
Yeah. I mean, I personally think that, you know, gambling should be legal and that internet gambling should be legal and that everything should be, you know, I'm extremely libertarian on these points, but the fact is that it was against the law and he took votes that could affect the family business.
He thought it should be legal too.
Right. But why did he think it should be legal? You know what I mean? He took votes that could affect the family business.
Maybe maybe for altruistic reasons. Maybe he thinks like you do that, you know, adults should be able to do what they want to do with their own time and their own money. And, you know, the government shouldn't be telling you that you can't gamble.
I'm sure that that was it.
You know, go to a prostitute or take drugs or what else?
I'll let you guys finish.
just Lawrence isn't in the district.
I misspoke.
So people know. Lawrence Cabral and Lawrence are in the third.
Yeah.
All right, we'll let it end at that. Rob Eno from Red Mask Group and Glenn Johnson from the Boston Globe. Thanks so much. It's politics as usual. And Callie Crossley is back here in Studio 3. What do you got?
Emily, do you know anyone who got a job in July?
No.
Well, we're going to check in with Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson for a look at the jobs report and talk about how many more jobs need to be created to make a real dent in unemployment. We're also going to talk about how President Obama and Mitt Romney are spinning those latest numbers.
All right, sounds good. I'm Emily Rooney.
And I'm Callie Crossley, and this is Boston Public Radio.
What could be better on a hot summer night in a Midwestern town than watching classic cars cruise by?
Anybody can have, you know, a car show in like a Dairy Queen parking lot. But I think people really enjoy the town square and the old historic buildings.
Sharing an American pastime, another summer night later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4, here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Bridge Bank, building long-term relationships with entrepreneurs and businesses throughout the country and with East Coast offices in Boston and in Reston, Virginia. You can find them on the web at bridgebank.com. And Natick VNA, a nationally accredited not-for-profit home care agency serving Greater Boston, striving to provide professional and compassionate care that is typically covered by Medicare or other insurances. NaticVNA.org.
I'm Callie Crossley. This is Boston Public Radio. The July jobs report is out. 163,000 jobs have been added, and unemployment ticked up from 8.2 to 8.3%. The verdict is mixed. Meanwhile, President Obama and Mitt Romney are spinning these numbers in opposite directions. Joining me to talk about what the jobs report means for the economy and how it's playing out on the campaign trail is Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson. Jeremy Hobson, thank you for joining us.
Good to be here, Kelly.
So, we have to start with, you know, the obvious, which is so weird that jobs were added, a lot of jobs, way more than thought possible right now. But at the same time, the unemployment number went up. It's hard to fathom what that all means.
Well, there are two surveys involved in getting the jobs report, and what is said by economists is that more people come back into the labor force and start looking for work, which sends that unemployment rate up. Here in this case, what economists were telling us on Friday is it's something slightly different and kind of complicated going on with the household survey, which asks people in households if they're employed, and that number was slightly different. But the fact is, I think if you dig down, you said 8.2 up to 8.3%. I think it's something like 8.24 up to 8.25 or something like that percent. So it pretty much stayed the same in the month of July.
All right. Well, so we have that. So we have kind of a mixed verdict, calculated differently, all of that. If you tease out some of the background, the jobs that were offered were from the private sector. So, you know, by all accounts, everything that I keep hearing is that's a good thing that the private sector is stepping up and offering jobs at a time when many folks in the private sector feel, as they say, a little tenuous about offering jobs.
A little uneasy.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, 172,000 jobs were in the private sector. And as you said, it's 163,000 were the amount of jobs added. So it's even more than 100%. 9,000 government jobs at state and local governments, in addition to perhaps the federal government, were lost during the month of July. But it is good news, because if you look back over the last 2 years, I was looking this up, and 660,000 government jobs have been lost during that period. But at the same time, we have had job growth of, you know, anywhere from, 20,000 up to a couple of 100,000 jobs a month. So it is the private sector that is doing the work of creating jobs right now, and the government sector that's cutting back.
But we've been hearing from a number of critics that bloated government employment. So now we got 9,000 jobs gone away. I don't know from what, attrition or maybe other things. But if the private sector is feeling, even in a tenuous state, confident enough to offer these many jobs, not as many as one might want, but still quite a lot, yep. Is that a sign of confidence that folks are not looking at?
You know, it's a sign of some confidence. Obviously, there are some big picture issues right now that are making people nervous. The European debt crisis is among them. Also, the fiscal cliff that we're coming up to later this year when these spending cuts and tax increases expire, or tax cuts expire. And so there are some big picture issues that are making people worried. But it was interesting because on Friday, when the jobs report came out on the Marketplace Morning Report, we spoke with the representatives of the Romney campaign campaign, as well as President Obama's top economist, Alan Krueger. And they both had very different views about what was going on with the jobs report. The Obama people said, this is better news. Look, this is compared to last month when we had less than 100,000 jobs. This is 163,000. This is much better news. We're moving in the right direction. And Governor Romney's, one of his top economists, Glenn Hubbard, came on the show and said, look, the unemployment rate is going up. This is not as good as we could be. And the only reason that those people are saying that this is good news for the economy is because compared to the terrible jobs reports we've had over the last few months, it is good news. So it's kind of a relative picture, and it depends on where you look at it from.
But from a political standpoint, if it essentially stays the same, which is what you just said, from the 8.2425, that's the same.
Right.
Where does that, whose column does that go in?
Well, that would not be a good thing for President Obama. Although, as you've seen in the campaign, they're able to distract and talk about other issues and whatever. But the other thing is, you've probably heard everyone say this is a very clear choice election. This is a clear choice between two candidates who are very different. And one of the things that we were starting to notice is that it's actually a very cloudy election on the jobs and economy front, which is the number one issue for voters, because both sides are making the argument, the kind of very difficult to get into what if argument about what would happen if. The Romney people were saying to us on Friday, you know, if only there wasn't all this new regulation coming with the healthcare law and Wall Street reform, things would be much better. Governor Romney could make the recovery better. The Obama people are looking at this and saying, you know, if only the Republicans would have passed President Obama's jobs initiatives, things would be much better. So you have a very difficult to determine what if situation that, Americans are going to have to figure out on their own. But it's hard to tell whether we'd be in better shape one way or the other.
And in fact, both of their arguments have some resonance somewhere, even for folks who may not agree with them. I was looking at your Romney guy, and he says we need to stabilize, you know, tax policies, get these policies stabilized. And that makes business owners, that's the private sector, feel more confident about whether or not they can actually hire people. We see this morning from the New York Times a whole article about business owners feeling uncomfortable, not quite as comfortable as they'd like to be because they're not quite sure about this. So that seems to play to his field,
Well, there is something to be said for uncertainty. I mean, you see it in any business. I see it right here, at American Public Media. When there's some uncertainty about what's going on in the future, you're not sure. You don't want to make a decision because you don't know what's going to happen. But you could make the same case about government spending. You could make the same case about tax cuts. When you talk to the kind of down the middle economists, which we do all the time on the show, you can't make the argument that less government spending, which is what President Obama likes in some of these jobs initiatives that he's trying to get Congress to put through, would that less government spending would help the economy, but also more tax cuts would help the economy. So it's hard to cut through it all.
And in fact, to President Obama's side, I mean, he's made the point, looking at, again, behind the numbers of this latest report, that the areas of weakness were construction and education. And that's exactly, he says, or his people say, that if Congress would pass the American Jobs Act, these two areas of weakness would be shored up with the government spending about which you just talked about.
That's right. Those are exactly the areas that he's been putting focus on. And in fact, by the way, in the 163,000 jobs that were created last month, if you look at the two of the big areas of growth, it was manufacturing 25,000 new jobs and restaurants and bars up 25,000, which that's got to be a good sign for some people looking at this, because it means that, people are going out to eat. They're going out to have a drink here and there. And of course, the all important manufacturing industry, which encompasses, the auto industry, which is doing better than a lot of people would have thought at this point. Those have got to be good signs for President Obama at this point.
And Jeremy, Massachusetts, or you're not looking just at one state, but you're looking, of course, course, nationally at the wider picture. But in Massachusetts, we just got a report from the Dukakis Center for Urban and Regional Policy at Northeastern University that we're seeing growth here in Massachusetts beyond, as Barry Bluestone, the director, says, the healthcare sector, education, and financial services. And our manufacturing is actually going up. And we've seen some growth in the areas you just mentioned, leisure and hospitality. So from what you know, is Massachusetts looking better than a lot of other states?
Look, I mean, I think when you look at a state like Massachusetts, you have to recognize that that highly educated is what you think of when you think of the workforce in Massachusetts. You have that in a lot of the northeastern states, and that's the key right now. I mean, if you look at the jobless rate among college graduates, it's very low. It's under 5%, I think. And in Massachusetts, you've got a state where you've got a very highly educated population, and that's going to help all sectors of the economy.
So, not that you have a crystal ball, but of course I like to ask these questions. The next jobs report, because the last one, fewer jobs than thought for. This one, everybody thought was going to be about the same. More jobs added. So where do you think it's coming down?
Look, we're not going to change the unemployment rate much from 8.3% from now until the election. I mean, it could come down 0.1% or so, between now and then. I don't think it's going to be below 8%. And I think that's the all important time frame, really. You know, you want to know what's going to happen in the next 3 months. I think we're going to be right about where we are right now. But the fact is, we're coming out of the worst recession since the Great Depression. So, you know, people can make their own judgments about whether we should be able to get out of that in a 4-year period or not.
All right. Now, just because we didn't deal with it, and I just want to get your take, what about these people who've stopped looking? Is the fact that the private sector seems to be more amenable, even in a smaller way than one would hope, to hiring, is there hope for those people who've stopped looking that they may, in fact, be employed?
Yeah, I mean, there's more than 5 million people, according to the latest figures, that have been out of work for 6 months or more. And you know, of course, there's always hope for people but it gets much harder. The longer you're out of work, the harder it is to get a new job. Employers want to know, what have you been doing? Why have you not been able to find work during this time? And so it's a difficult situation for those people. It gets more difficult with every day that goes by, but there's always hope.
I have to say, Jeremy, you've probably done stories on it. We have here about a lot of companies and employers that will only hire people who are currently working. So
right.
That adds to this.
Absolutely. I mean, that you know, when an employer is looking for an employee, they also kind of want to know that employee has other folks that want that person to be working for them, too. That's the way it works in every business. And I think that is what is contributing in part to what's going on with the long term unemployed.
All right. So when is the next jobs report out?
1 month. The first Friday of September.
Well, I guess we'll be watching. It's been a roller coaster.
Indeed.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
I'm Callie Crossley, and we've been talking about the July Jobs Report with Jeremy Hobson. Jeremy Hobson is the host of Marketplace Morning Report. You can catch him here on WGBH Monday through Friday throughout our 5 a.m. to 10 a.m. broadcast. You can also catch Marketplace with Kai Rizdahl tonight at 6 o'clock. Emily Rooney is back in Studio 3 right now. And Emily, a major move in space exploration, right?
I know. I think this story is so cool. So those 15 minutes of terror worked out pretty well for NASA. In the wee hours of the morning, the Mars rover Curiosity landed safely. We're going to be talking to NASA astronaut and MIT professor Jeff Hoffman.
Sounds interesting. That's Emily Rooney. I'm Callie Crossley. And this is Boston Public Radio.